The Tom Hartman Show on Nova M Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our Friday program. As always, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our second and third hour. Anything goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on a wide variety of topics and talking about the news of the day. But first, Senator Sanders, the independent from Vermont, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, previously the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives in that body's history, now the independent senator from Vermont, founder of the Progressive Caucus, Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Bernie, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
By the way, just a shout-out from some fellow Vermonters, Hal and Shelley Cohen. Hal is the executive director of the Central Vermont Community Action Program and has, you know Hal for years.
Yes.
They've been staying in our house all this week. And Hal said to say hi to Bernie. So
Hal does a great job, and we have community agencies, community action programs all over America that are the very lifeline to the lowest-income people in this country. These are the agencies that provide emergency food, emergency housing, keep people alive. And needless to say, it's a program that the President of the United States wanted to cut back substantially, but he ain't going to do it.
Yeah. Well, and only in large part because we have Democratic control of the House and Senate now, I would guess.
That's a good point. There's a lot of Congresses now on a Memorial Day break. We'll be coming back Monday night or Tuesday. A lot of issues that are going to be surfacing. Let me just go over a few of them, if I might.
Sure.
The energy bill will be making its way to the floor. A lot of controversy over that. To my view, the time is long overdue for the United States Congress to be bold, to be aggressive in breaking our dependency on fossil fuel, move to energy efficiency, move to sustainable energy. And you know, Tom, folks have been talking about this for many, many years. But the really good news is that we now have the technology out there. We know how to do it. And if we have the political will to do the right thing, we can make huge progress in reversing global warming, cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions. And in the process, and what excites me very much, while there will clearly be economic dislocation as you move away from fossil fuels, at the end of the day, I think we can create a hell of a lot more jobs than we lose, including good-paying jobs. You're seeing countries like Germany doing the right thing. You're seeing California doing the right thing. In California, their expectation, and they are funding a process by which they're going to have 1 million rooftop photovoltaic units within the next 10 years. We should be doing that nationally, 10 million units, creating a whole lot of jobs as we produce these products, as we install these products. Wind turbines have great potential, especially if we are, and we can create jobs if we are producing these turbines in the United States, geothermal. A lot of jobs can be created as we move to sensible energy policy. In addition to that, in my view, we have got to catch up to Europe, Japan, China even, in terms of mass transportation, in terms of significantly improving our decaying rail system. And this is just an extraordinary opportunity to turn America around in terms of energy.
So, I'm sorry. Good.
So that's one area you're going to see a whole lot of debate on. And to my mind, instead of giving tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, we should be making it easier for people to buy energy efficient automobiles, hybrids, appliances, retrofit their homes, provide tax credits both for the producers of solar products as well as for consumers. California is doing that. You can get a significant rebate when you install a solar unit on your roof. You can get a very significant rebate when you install in rural areas a wind turbine.
Go ahead. There's another piece to this, and I was in Germany last year and saw all these solar panels. I mean, it's incredible. In fact, you and I have talked about it, I think, on this program. And Samuel Mueller, the guy I was staying with, said that they were buying their solar panels from a company in France that was, the, at that time, the largest manufacturer of solar panels in Europe. China came in and bought that French factory, dismantled it piece by piece, moved the entire factory to China, and now it's made in China. Don't we also need to be changing our trade policy
Absolutely.
So we don't end up creating an industry that,
well,
is being done from China?
My understanding is, in fact, a lot of the solar technology was originally developed right here in the United States of America.
Yep. Yep.
And in the United States, not just Germany going elsewhere to France for their products. In the United States, people have to go abroad in order to buy these units. So to my mind, as we move toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy, what we do also want to focus on is to make sure that these products are manufactured in the United States. Massachusetts now is just expanding a plant there to produce photovoltaics. Michigan, they have several plants that are doing that, hiring a lot of people in the process. But this is clearly what we have got to do, and you're right. It ties right into our trade policies, which are also going to be surfacing very, very shortly. There are a number of trade agreements out there, and also the reauthorization of the fast track program will be coming up in June. To my mind, as I've said on this show many, many times, with a $700+ billion trade deficit and the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, it should be clear to everybody that our current trade deficit trade policies have been a disaster. It's forcing wages down in America, the loss of good-paying jobs, and it's imperative to my mind that we kill this effort on the part of the President and some in Congress to reauthorize Fast Track, that we start negotiating trade agreements that work for the middle class and working people of this country rather than the CEOs and the large corporations. So that is going to be coming up right up front and center within the next month or two. And I hope people participate in that debate.
Mm-hmm.
Very important issue. Now, another area, we have finished the budget process, and these bills are now going to the appropriating committees, different appropriating committees. One area where I believe that we are making significant progress is in adequately funding the needs of our veterans. I think many listeners are familiar with what happened at Walter Reed. Many listeners know that under George W. Bush, despite all of his wonderful comments about how much he loves the troops, the fact of the matter is the Veterans Administration has been grossly underfunded for a number of years. My hope and expectation is that you're going to see the largest increase in funding for our veterans that we have seen in many, many years. That's something I'm going to fight very hard for. We need to do that in order to do away with the backlogs in claims that our veterans have to fight through. Sometimes they're processing a claim. It takes months and months and months and years before they get to hear back from the VA and get these claims adjudicated. Furthermore, there are waiting lists all over America for health care for our veterans. And on top of that, we have now over 24,000 soldiers who have been wounded in Iraq. And then we're looking at record-breaking, unprecedented number of folks who are going to be coming home from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's going to be a very, very serious problem here in Vermont. We have been working here in Vermont with the VA and with the National Guard trying to develop an outreach program which will bring people, help and make it easier for families to readjust and get the help that they need. The truth of the matter is that serving in Iraq has been extraordinarily difficult. It is a terrible theater to be in. These guys are under pressure 24 hours a day. They're seeing things that people should not have to see. And we've got to do everything we can to readjust them back to civilian life. So that's going to be an expensive process, but we've got to obviously do it. We've got to keep the promises that we made to those people who went over there. So the issue of veterans issues is going to be coming up. Trade's going to be coming up. We just passed, as you know, finally. I mean, it is beyond belief that it has taken this long, but it is one of the accomplishments of the new Democratic control of the Congress that we finally did pass a minimum wage bill. At $7.25 an hour to be phased in over a few years. The fact that that bill, that wage is now at $5.15 an hour is beyond comprehension, and so that's a step forward. Congress, as many listeners know, is now dealing with the immigration bill. It's a long and complicated bill, many, many provisions in it, some of which, to my mind, are good. Some of them clearly are not good. The concerns that I have is that you have many people, both in the high-tech industry and in the low-wage area, who want more cheap labor coming into this country to depress wages even further, and that's something we're going to fight against. So.
Good on you. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. You want to drop into our live chat room, go to airamerica.com or tomhartman.com. Click on the Tom Hartman link and then the live chat link, and you can drop it and say hi. We'll be right back with Senator Bernie Sanders. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
This is Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX. You're listening to Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
Throw it all, give it, live in the moment. Don't get too far ahead, don't live in the past. I blink my eyes and the moment is over. I guess another day has passed. But it's just another day. It's just another day.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Sanders answering your questions. 1-866-303-2270. Dick in London, Ontario, Canada on the line. Hey, Dick, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Hello, Senator Sanders. Hello, Tom. What I'm calling about is the issue of reimportation of drugs. I believe you have championed the concept of reimportation as a way to solve the problem of drug pricing in the United States. Living in Canada, that concerns me quite a bit because we have managed to, through developing our Medicare system and through negotiations with the drug companies, develop a system where we have cheaper drugs. And just a minute, somebody's calling on me on the line here. Let me kill this. We have cheaper drugs and better laws regarding generics than they have in the United States. My concern is that if reimportation from the United States is increased, if I was the drug companies, I'd just go to the Canadian government and say, deal's off. And in the end, what would happen is the price of drugs in Canada would go up, and the only beneficiary would be the pharmaceutical companies. The United States wouldn't get any more expensive drugs, and Canada would pay more for its drugs. And I think the phrase, thanks a lot, would come up. I'd kind of wish that the Americans would come up with their own way of solving their drug pricing issues.
Okay, Dick, you raised some good points, and there's some truth, I think, in what you're saying. The truth of the matter is that in recent years, as a result of some of our efforts in the Congress to say not just that Americans and pharmacists and prescription drug distributors should be able to purchase low-cost, affordable medicine from Canada, but also from throughout Europe as well. So don't think of this just as a Canadian issue. What has happened in recent years is the pharmaceutical industry, which is the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., in this country, which spent close to $1 billion in the last 10 years on lobbyists alone, not to mention campaign contributions, not to mention advertising. They have, in fact, put a lot of pressure on the Canadian government, and Dick's concerns are legitimate. It's not my view, Dick, that this is the solution to our problem, and you are quite right. What we should be doing in this country is what every other industrialized country does, and that is negotiate prices with the drug companies so they don't charge us by far the highest prices in the world and they don't rip off the American people. Unfortunately, the drug companies are much too powerful in this country and own the White House, have a lot of influence over many members of the House and Senate. Unfortunately, we can't do that. The best that we can do is say to people in the House and the Senate and to the White House, you believe in unfettered free trade. You think that that's a great idea. I personally don't. They do. And what we're saying is that if in America we can bring in huge amounts of food products from China, from Mexico, from throughout Latin America, we can bring in all kinds of products from every country in the world. How come we cannot bring in FDA-regulated medicines from Canada, from England, from Germany, from France, from Scandinavia, etc. So what we're trying to do there is use this as one approach. It is not the best approach. It is one approach so that the American people can pay the same prices for medicine that people throughout the world are doing. But if Dick's point is that we have got to do better as a government in standing up to our own drug companies to lower prices, he is quite right.
Chris in Salinas, California, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Chris.
This is Chris.
You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bernie, I'm kind of disturbed or concerned about your support of Dianne Feinstein's bill regarding election integrity and supporting the electronic voting machines. And I just want to point out that when you cast a vote on a DRE machine, there is absolutely no way you can tell whether or not your vote was recorded as cast. It's impossible. And the VPAT, the Voterified Verified Audit Trail, is not the voter record and is rarely ever used in any sort of a recount. And in Orange County, they didn't even use it in a recount. So I just want to... So if you have any questions on that.
Sure. Well, Chris, my own view is that we should, in this country, be moving probably at this point back to paper ballots until we understand or believe that the touchscreen process is 100% foolproof, which is certainly not the case right now. But I think the idea that in those areas where we are using touchscreens to have a paper trail, I think that makes sense, and I think that's a step forward. But as you know, there are some states now. I think it is Maryland, Tom. Is that right? Where they're now moving back to paper ballots?
Yeah, New Mexico, I think, because they had the experience of in those precincts where people voted on paper, they voted for Kerry, and on machines, they voted for Bush in the same schools.
Right.
And
so, I think the idea of moving back to paper ballots makes sense, but I think making sure that we have a paper trail for touchscreens at this point is also a step forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very concerned about how diluted Rush Holt's bill has become. I'm thinking it's probably more toxic than good, but in any case, Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders.
The Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain, on Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX. This is Nova M. Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
In your mind. Heart for heart and soul for soul, somebody said, what is true? Lock it up and close it down, the sound of mourning like a dove. High beyond the rattle and roar, look into the face of love.
34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Pat in San Diego, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm very concerned about the balance of power in the Senate. If Lieberman switches parties, is it really true that the Democrats would lose their majority control?
The answer is yes. But I don't think that that's going to happen. If Senator Lieberman were to go to the Republicans, that would create a 50-50 tie. And Vice President Cheney would vote with the Republicans, giving them the majority. I don't think that is going to happen, though.
Now, if that did happen, though, Bernie, under the new Senate rules, wouldn't the Democrats retain their chairmanships of the Senate committees and the subpoena power?
But it would obviously be a significant shift in power. I personally don't believe that that is going to happen.
Okay. Craig in Linwood, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. I just wanted to bring up the issue of caging and find out how much amongst you and the committees are talking about it. And concerns me is there are things like Monica Goodling, the issue that the guy who's the attorney for Arkansas now was involved in that. in the 2004 election, and it just seems to me something that is really an issue that really needs to be looked into. And
well, Craig, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, if there's anything that democracy is supposed to be about, is the right of every person to be able to cast their ballot freely and without intimidation. And I think for many years now, part of the Republican game plan has been to do everything that it can to suppress the voter turnout in the minority communities and elsewhere. And they do this through intimidation and a variety of other mechanisms. So you're right. This is an issue that should be brought to light. And those people, anybody who uses illegal means to try to intimidate people so that they don't vote should be punished severely.
Yeah, indeed. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi. I'm in traffic. I don't know how well you can hear me.
Just fine.
Okay. I asked Tom this question last week. It had been suggested by Randy Rhodes that if 2 million people showed up in Washington, D.C. and protested the war, Congress would reverse its decision and not fund the war anymore. I was wondering if Senator Sanders thought that might be the case.
Well, I think when people speak in whatever form, through demonstrations, through emails, through letters, the Congress, in fact, listens to them. The basic problem in terms of ending this disastrous war, which has done so much harm to our country and our standing in the world and loss of lives for Americans and Iraqis and $500 billion spent, and et cetera, et cetera. The basic problem is that you have a president who refuses to listen to the American people, refuses to listen to many of his past and even present military advisors, and wants to continue doing the same old thing except even expanding and accelerating what he is doing. And I think it will be the American people who will bring this horrendous war to an end by putting pressure on the Congress, and especially, I must say, on Republicans who right now are going home and are hearing from their constituencies that there is growing dissatisfaction with this war. And I've said before, and let me repeat it again, that when a dozen Republicans walk into the White House and said, we've had it, our constituents no longer believe in your policies, the war will end. Obviously, the political problem that you have right now is that, as you remember, a month ago, Congress did pass legislation in terms of the supplemental budget, which had timelines for the withdrawal of American troops. Bush vetoed it. We don't have the votes to override that veto. That's where we are right now. But I think pressure from the American people, especially on Republicans, could bring this war to an end, hopefully a lot sooner than later.
Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders.
Good morning.
And also, Tom, I have a question about yesterday's one of the Senate committee hearings concerning the torture bill. And I understand that Senator Nelson voted in favor of maintaining it. And this just infuriates me because I think there are issues that we just cannot compromise on. And torture and the FISA law, you know, some of these are just basic to our civil rights, our human rights, our country's constitution. And I just cannot understand why this would happen this way.
Well, there are two Nelsons in the Senate, by the way.
From
one.
Florida.
Bill Nelson. The answer is I agree with you. I don't think, you know, one of the things that has distressed many Americans the most about Bush's administration, and there's so much to be distressed by, is that when he came into office, our country was, as it had been for so many years, one of the most admired and respected countries around the world. People from the developing world, people in the industrialized world, looked to America as something that in many ways they wanted to emulate. And certainly under President Bush, our standing in terms of world opinion has deteriorated very, very significantly. And one of the many reasons why is that when we have a president who implies, or a Congress which implies, that torture is acceptable, people around the world just simply shake their head. So I agree with you, Bernice. I think torture has no place in what we as Americans do, and I will do my best to make sure that that becomes very clear.
Debbie in Tierras, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good morning, Senator Sanders and Tom. My question is regarding the National Security Presidential Directive 51. The subject of the NSPD 51 is entitled National Continuity Policy and states that the president shall lead the activities of the federal government for ensuring constitutional government and designates the president as the coordinator of the cooperative effort among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. I want to know if I know Tom has talked about this on his show recently, and I want to know, has there been or will there be any attention given to this in Congress, and what can we do as citizens to raise the alarm about these directives?
Debbie, as I mentioned earlier, I think to the degree that we have an informed and active electorate who are communicating with their members of Congress, especially at this time when we have such a right-wing extremist administration, and letting members of Congress know that as constituents they are following what's going on, they want congressional action, they want people to stand up to this president. Every day that we do that is a successful day, and I think we should put as much pressure as we can on members of the House, members of the Senate. I think in terms of this particular issue, I suspect it will be surfacing in the appropriate committee. I mean, one of the problems that exists now in the Congress is that for 6 years we had a rubber stamp Congress who basically did not look in any of the activities of the Bush administration. And right now you're seeing committees in both the House and the Senate working overtime, trying to regain some of the lost ground over those previous 6 years in doing so many things. I mean, there's just so many issues out there that have got to be reviewed. But I suspect that the issue you raise is certainly one of those that has to be looked at.
Yeah, this one is particularly startling because it says for the first time that it means any catastrophic emergency means any incident regardless of location and that it severely affects the U.S. economy. I mean, the Great Depression would trigger this thing. And then it puts the president in charge of the legislative branch.
You know, Tom, one of the problems with the Bush administration is that almost every day there is something literally outrageous that comes down the pike.
Yeah.
And it's they've almost...
How do you keep track of it all?
Exactly. They've almost redefined the word outrageous. What does it mean? I mean, what are they going to be saying or proposing tomorrow? So, but what it does mean, to answer, you know, Debbie's question, is that this Congress with new leadership has got to be working overtime to keep track of all these things, to turn these things around. And I want to tell people, I know that, you know, within the progressive community, there is obviously great consternation about this administration and so forth and so on. But within the last few months, while the Democratic leadership has not done everything that I want them to do or that many of the listeners want them to do, there have been some changes. You'll remember that it wasn't so long ago that you had President Bush saying, we will never talk to Iran. Axis of evil, Syria, terrible. Well, you know what? They are beginning to understand that what negotiations and diplomacy are about is talking to people you don't like and not just your friends. So they're beginning to talk to Iran, beginning to talk to Syria, which I think is a step in the right direction. So I think if we keep putting up the pressure, and they are, as you also know, last week there was a leak that coming out that the White House intend to significantly cut back on troops in Iraq in the not-too-distant future. So I don't want people to think for a moment that the pressure from the grassroots does not have an impact. Much too slow, admittedly, but we're having some impact.
So keep on making
yeah.
those phone calls and contacting. Yeah, and you can call Congress at 202-225-3121. That's the number on Capitol Hill. And you can ask for either of your senators or your member of the House of Representatives and share your thoughts with them. 202-225-3121. 45 minutes past the hour. Right back with Bernie Sanders.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
As quiet as she is now, forever will she be a silent celebration.
A wicked land dream.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Craig in Iowa, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hello, Craig.
Hi. What are we going to do about these signing statements? If we don't impeach this president, what's the next president going to come along and do whatever he wants with the Constitution? I mean, we have basically no Constitution left now.
What we're going to do with the signing statements, which in case some listeners don't know what they are, is when the president signs a bill, he has decided that he will write down those provisions of the bill that he wants to see enforced and those provisions that he doesn't, which to my mind is clearly unconstitutional. So along with many other areas, we're going to fight them. And I think what we are going to try to do is to put together a strong, politically conscious grassroots movement which turns this country around. It's not going to happen as quickly as people want it to. But when we keep our eyes on the prize, we can do a couple of things. Number one, we have already, I think, to a significant degree, stopped right-wing extremism in this country. And the next thing that we have to do is to create majorities in the House and the Senate, which will be strong. In the Senate, we need 60 votes, really, to make things happen. We have to elect a president who is going to listen to working families, is going to address the crisis of the declining middle class and the growing gap between the rich and the poor. We're going to put pressure on all of the candidates so that we can join the rest of the industrialized world and have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people. There's a lot that has to be done, but there are no shortcuts. What really has to occur, in my view, is people have got to focus on the political process, get involved, put pressure on the candidates to stand up for people who today are often not getting a fair shake from their government. We've got to turn around this country in a way that begins to allow us to be the country that we know we can become, not the nation which has the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. So there's a lot of work to be done. I don't think there are any magical solutions. George Bush is not going to be impeached. You're not going to have anywhere near the votes to try to do that. The goal is to involve people in the political process, increase the voter turnout, create a political consciousness so that working people know that they can't be voting against their own best interest. They can't be voting for people who are going to send their jobs to China, who want to privatize Social Security, or give tax breaks to billionaires while they cut back on health care for their kids. So there's a lot of work to be done. No shortcuts. Hard, old-fashioned educational work, organizing work. And if we do that, we can, in fact, move this country in a very, very different direction.
Yeah, and this is the way every movement from ending slavery to suffrage to civil rights, it's all been done. It's a lot of shoe leather.
It's a lot of shoe leather, and it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, the struggle for women's rights in this country, the struggle for civil rights, the struggle for gay rights, the struggle for a semblance of a sane environmental policy, on and on it goes. It is a lot of hard work. In my view, no shortcuts. It's educating. It's organizing. Is having the American people involved in the political process and say, hey, wait a second. You know, this government doesn't just belong to the large multinationals and the wealthiest people in this country. It belongs to all of us. And when we begin to do that, man, we can do a lot of wonderful things for our country.
Yeah, I agree. Nancy in Tualatin, Oregon. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. I'm calling with regard to the Supreme Court appointments, and I know that they, as well as a federal bench, are lifetime appointments. I've been thinking about this a lot, that when the Constitution was written, the life expectancy in this country was approximately in the early to middle 40s. I don't think our founders ever envisioned individuals sitting on the Supreme Court for 25, 30, 35, 40 years. And so my suggestion, and this is not a frivolous suggestion, is that I think it's just too much power in the hands of too few people for too long a time. And I think there should be a constitutional amendment to say that appointments to the federal bench, including the Supreme Court, should be a one-time 15-year appointment. And I'd like to know what you think about that.
It's a pretty radical concept. It's an interesting concept. I can't give you a definitive answer. In the sense that what lifetime appointments are supposed to be about is that you are freeing people from the day-to-day politics, which could influence their decisions. And presumably when you give somebody a lifetime appointment, they have the ability to go into their hearts and into their souls and into the law
and come up with the best decisions, regardless of public opinion or what the president may want or what Congress may want. That's the theory behind it.
And to the issue of longevity, while the average lifespan was shorter, that's simply the average. We had much higher infant mortality. John Marshall, who was appointed to the bench by John Adams, was on the bench into his 80s. I mean, many of the founders lived late, well into their 70s and 80s. It was not at all uncommon back in that day. So,
and also, to my mind, for the immediate moment, is that we have got to stop, and I think we will. With the new Congress, the appointment of right-wing extremists to our court system.
Yeah, okay. Jerry in Phoenix, Arizona. We got about a minute here left, Jerry. What's up?
Yes,
Jerry?
Yes, sir. I need to find out. Are you there, sir?
Yes.
Yes.
I'd like to find out about, so I understand that if you put solar on your house, that the government will give you a $15,000 grant. Is that true, sir?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear your question, Jerry.
He said if you put solar on your house, will the government give you a $15,000 grant?
In California right now, there are states that are doing some fairly aggressive work in this. In California, I believe you'll get a $10,000 rebate. There is a federal tax credit, which I believe is up to $2,000. So in California, you would get $12,000.
That's not bad. We need more of that
right
across the United States.
Right.
I mean, this is something that we really, really, truly need to be
doing. And that's an issue that's going to be coming up within the next few weeks, and that deals with tax credits for sustainable energy.
Yeah, good. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Always great having you on the program. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on pretty much anything you want to talk about. I've got a couple of short news stories here, and some of the events of the day we'll be updating you on right after the news at the top of the hour. Stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
I did Clinton. Okay.
You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, it looks like they're starting to get serious, the folks in Nigeria, with Pfizer. This from The Independent in the UK. Oddly, not much about this in the American press. In fact, frankly, I haven't seen anything about this in the American press. But this in the one of the largest newspapers in the United Kingdom. Article by Andrew Gumbel in Los Angeles. The U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has been slapped with criminal charges in Nigeria over a notorious clinical trial it conducted on children during a meningitis epidemic a decade ago. If you saw the movie, what was the title of that movie? It was The Constant Gardener, as I recall. If you saw that movie, that was actually based on something that actually happened. John Le Carre wrote a novel about it. Pfizer and its representatives will be called to account at hearings due to begin next month in the Nigerian state of Kano, where public anger over the clinical trial and the assurances of any pharmaceutical company remains so high that the local population won't even trust the Nigerian government to immunize their children against polio. This is the problem. This is what has provoked the government of Nigeria to sue Pfizer for well over $1 billion. The suit contends that the Nigerian authorities say Pfizer researchers selected children and infants from a crowded epidemic camp in Kano in 1996 and gave about half of them an untested antibiotic called Trovan. This was the Pfizer product. The lawsuit alleges that the researchers did not obtain consent from the children's families, even though they knew from their own research that Trovan might have life-threatening side effects and was unfit for human use. The suit further contends that the researchers gave the other half of the children a comparison drug made by Pfizer's competitor, Hoffmann La Roche, but deliberately underdosed them to make their own product look better. Pfizer and its doctors, quote, agreed to do an illegal act, end quote, the suit says, quote, in a manner so rash and negligent as to endanger human life, end quote. Once the trial was over, the suit contends Pfizer left the area, removed all medical records, and obliterated any evidence of the trial. A Nigerian government report, which appears to have spurred the criminal charges, previously found that Pfizer never told the children or their parents that they were participating in a trial and did not inform them that alternative treatments were available. Most obviously, chlorafenicol, a relatively cheap antibiotic usually recommended for treatment of bacterial meningitis. Back in 1997, when Pfizer faced a U.S. government audit of its records on Trovan, the company produced a letter from a hospital in Kano saying that the study had been approved by the hospital's ethics committee. The company's accusers contend that the letter was fabricated after the fact using a forged letterhead, and in fact that hospital has no ethics committee. The Nigerian decision to prosecute Pfizer marks the first known instance of a third world country going after a pharmaceutical multinational. The drug, by the way, has never been approved for use on U.S. children. It was cleared for adults in 1997, but its use was restricted 2 years later following reports of liver damage and death. It is banned throughout Europe. So, interesting. And also in the news today, just kind of economic news, is where as we see these multinationals, I remember Michael Dell. I used to run the PC forum, the IBM PC forum on CompuServe, and he was making computers, and as far as I could tell, out of the bedroom in his house. I mean, this is back in the 80s. And he built this company up, and he was a very nice guy. I mean, he was online. He was doing tech support and stuff. I understand he's a big Republican supporter these days, but still, what can I say? I didn't know him but he was in there, and he was hanging out with us and talking with folks and selling his computers. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. But when you run a large company, you've got to do what the stockholders require, essentially. And what the stockholders are requiring, or what Michael Dell is in favor, who knows? I mean, the Round Rock, here's the story from Christopher Lawton in today's Wall Street Journal. Moving to turn around ailing Dell Inc., founder and chief executive Michael Dell announced layoffs at the company for the first time since 2001. The Round Rock's Texas personal computer company yesterday said it would lay off 10% of its workforce, or about 8,800 people, over the next year. The layoffs, which Wall Street had been calling for, are part of Mr. Dell's strategy to fix the company, whose sales have been beaten by rival Hewlett-Packard Company over the past year. And, looking at the HP computers, it seems like the ones that I see in the stores are not made in the United States. Bob Zoellick, by the way, nominated as president of the World Bank, an executive with Goldman Sachs. What particularly troubled me was day before yesterday, I was watching the PBS NewsHour, what used to be the McNeil-Lehrer report, now I believe it's called the NewsHour, and they were interviewing a couple of people about Bob Zoellick, and the thrust of it seemed to be, well, you know, how quick is it going to go, and how's it going to be, and what's the impact of Wolfowitz, and nobody ever raised the issue. Nobody ever raised the issue that, as Asia Russell, for example, of healthgap.org said, she's the director of international advocacy for the health group Health Gap. She said, during his tenure as U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Zoellick was well known among AIDS and public health advocates for lobbying for trade agreements that were major giveaways to the pharmaceutical industry. Because of Bob Zoellick's efforts, these agreements will increase the cost of life-saving medicines in developing countries. He put drug company interests ahead of the interests of people living with HIV and other life-threatening diseases. He was on the wrong side of that debate. We're very concerned that Zoellick will apply the same flawed market fundamentalist thinking to the major health policy issues that have made the World Bank so ineffective in fighting poverty. It's very difficult, she said, to imagine the same Bob Zoellick who carried water for Big Pharma being the kind of advocate ministers of health need in order to expand their investments and salaries for doctors and nurses to address 6,000 preventable AIDS deaths every day in Africa alone. And in fact, the issue of Bob Zoellick pushing for global free trade, for these insane trade policies that have ripped apart America, for carrying water for the big pharma companies, for hurting AIDS work around the world by advocating in favor of the patents of these big companies and just that whole role was never even brought up. It's like it's not a subject that can be discussed. Oh, it might reflect poorly on the guy. It's incredible. 1-866-303-2270. Anything goes Friday. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, I'm wondering, when Bush decided to sign those the last emergency war funding statement alone, how do we know that he didn't decide to do one of those famous signing statements, and where could we find out?
You know, there is a website that a government site that posts that stuff. I don't have it right off the tip of my brain or tongue or whatever. It's drop into our live chat room, and somebody might be able to help you out with that. But here's my broadly the answer to that is that I don't believe that Bush has attached any outrageous signing statements to any legislation lately because they're being noticed. And it would be like giving Congress something, the Democrats in Congress, something that they could go after him with. So there probably was a signing statement, but it was probably, yes, I agree with this, and therefore I'm signing it kind of thing. But because I'm quite sure if it had been anything else, we would have heard about it by now.
How often has these emergency war funding bills been used to finance other American wars?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
It would be interesting to look back and do a study. Was World War II done this way? Was Vietnam done this way?
No, World War II is not done this way. Whether Vietnam was or not, I don't know. What I do know is that Vietnam, what I believe, my recollection is that the Vietnam War costs were rolled into the budget at the time. And of course, that was something that produced part of the economic disaster that came down the road with Jimmy Carter and whatnot. But as that was being wrung out of the economy in the last years of the Nixon administration as well. But The Bush administration, by having these emergency appropriations, these are essentially off budget. So when they say, oh, we've got a $200 billion deficit, they're not including things like the war funding, which is making it far, far worse. And so, it's just generally crazy. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, got about a half a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, Tom, you talk about political progressives infiltrating and joining the Democratic Party, but what about joining and infiltrating the Green Party and supporting their candidates and voting for them instead? Because, after all, we have so many Democrats, I realize not all of them, but 14.
Yeah, at the local level, Jerry, I'm totally in favor of that.
Free trade deals.
Jerry, thank you. At the local level, I'm totally in favor of that. And for that matter, at the national level, I think that it's possible for people to participate in multiple political parties. I realize that this is not something that everybody in politics likes to hear, but I think showing up and participating. The Green Party has been responsible for getting instant runoff voting passed in places like San Francisco. I mean, they're a major positive force in the United States, and we do need instant runoff voting so that we can get more multiple parties participating. At the same time, we can't, in my opinion, we can't walk away from the Democratic Party. We need to be far more aggressive, as Bernie was saying, in getting involved in the political process. And frankly, I think that means getting involved in that party and take it over from within. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes. God is just in a new barrel.
It's our Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ted in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ted.
Hi. Since it's Anything Goes Friday, I was wondering, I've only been listening for a couple months, and just found you. And I appreciate everything you guys are doing, but I haven't heard anything in the debate on renewable fuels and biofuels about hemp. And we know that there's a debate about ethanol and the use of food stuff, corn and sugar cane, to, in competing with its food uses, it's going to be used for oil, too. Hemp has the advantage of being able to, grow on marginal lands. But I'm not sure. Since I've only been listening for a couple months, have you guys addressed this?
Yeah, we have a number of times, and with some regularity. Hemp is one of the most efficient converters of sunlight into cellulose and into oils that can be used as fuels, and as well as food. I make jokes about it on the air, but I buy hemp milk. There's a company here in Oregon that makes hemp milk by the case. I love this stuff. I mean, I have celiac disease and can't eat things with wheat, and it screws up my ability to drink things that have milk in it. And so, I'm stuck with like rice milk and soy milk, and hemp milk is even better. And I love it. But and the Canadians are doing this. I mean, they're growing hemp like crazy up there, and many other countries are doing this as a way of generating basically biodiesel. And because it's a very high quality oil that hemp produces.
Sure, pressing the seeds. Pressing the seeds gives you basic.
Yeah, exactly.
Seeds.
And the thing that's preventing it here in the United States is this the general insanity left over from Harry Anslinger and J. Edgar Hoover, and, you know, these guys back in the 30s, which was basically the original war on drugs as a rubric for a war on African Americans, and it's continuing to this day. It's, you know, just the insanity associated with it, because hemp is the same genus but not the same species as marijuana, you know, as pot. They're all hysterical about it, and their main hysteria is that they're concerned that they won't be able to easily spot, you know, pot plants growing in the wild, because if we start growing industrial hemp, we'll have hemp plants growing in the wild, and then they won't be able to catch that little patch that somebody has growing in their backyard.
If they understood, they would know that industrial hemp would just ruin the marijuana. Cannabis, because the pollen from the industrial hemp.
It would interbreed with it and weaken it and dilute it. On the other hand, maybe the cannabis would get in with the industrial hemp, and then my hemp milk would taste a whole lot better.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right.
I don't know. But Ted, I'm a total advocate of using hemp and growing with hemp. And I, like I said, I drink it. There's a store around here someplace that sells a whole bunch of hemp stuff. I'm not sure if it's
100%. I thought the DEA outlawed hemp oil and hemp seed oil and everything. I thought they'd said that since it can cause a positive test that you're finding it.
You can Google the stuff. I buy it by the case. It comes in plain vanilla and chocolate, and it's absolutely. David's sitting here with me. He goes like, I like the stuff too. It's great. I'm always smiling when I'm drinking my hemp milk. Ted, thanks a lot for the call. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I agree. I love hemp milk, too. I've been able to get it in Arcata, so it's delicious, better than soy and almond and rice and everything else.
Yeah, I agree. It's a little thicker. It's a little and it says a great source of omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, which is good for brain function. Yeah.
So, well, my point is this. I think there's a framing going on, and unfortunately it's from Al Gore, so I wanted to run this by you. After the three different times in the last week I've heard him interviewed, and each time he's been asked the question, why didn't he fight the Supreme Court decision in 2000? And each time he said, well, the alternative, there were only two options, accept it or armed revolution. And I remember there being a third option, which was let the Congress decide. It might take a few months, but the Congress can, you know, there's some way that the Congress could decide this issue.
Right. And it required one senator to bring it forward.
Exactly.
There were members of the House who were willing to do so, but it required one senator, and there wasn't one senator. And Al Gore, frankly, I think probably appropriately, although it was a tragedy for democracy, Al Gore was not willing to be that senator because he was the guy that it was all about. And
right.
He was vice president, he was president of the Senate. And so I would look to all the other Democratic wimps in the Senate and say, you know, why didn't any of you step up? You know.
Well, I wish he would add that to his comments that he makes, because it seems to be setting up a, you know, something about him that's just sound bites, and I just don't appreciate that coming from him. Because of listening to you all this time, I can see through it with the, you know, the framing that's obviously going on when it's the same answer each time.
Yeah. Well, he's trying to make it simple, but you're absolutely right, Kate. It's I don't know if there's some kind of political calculus here, or if he's just trying to avoid, you know, the whole debate of that stuff and kind of move on. But
I wish he would just say all that and make us feel that we're getting complete honesty from somebody.
Yeah. It, that would be refreshing, wouldn't it? Kate, thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. Back with your calls right after this. 866-303-2270. Drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. So click live chat up at the top of the page, or go to AirAmerica.com. Click the Tom Hartman link, and then you'll see the link to our live chat room. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Nova M. Phoenix, 1480.
I love it. One of some of the, one of the favorite songs of my childhood, completely reinvented. By the way, the Hemp Milk Company, a bunch of people are coming into the chat room going, where do I find this stuff? It's actually a Portland company called Living Harvest Conscious Nutrition, and their website is livingharvest.com. So, and I have no affiliation with the company and get no money from them. This is not a commercial plug. I just drink their hemp milk. Although if they wanted to advertise, I wouldn't mind. But that's not why I'm saying it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Phyllis in Sebastopol, California. Hey, Phyllis.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here, and thanks for your vision. I have a conspiracy about it seems like the Democrats need not only a tongue lashing about those who voted for spending the war, giving Bush the war money again, but they also need some support. It seems to me that the Republicans are still doing a better job of framing the issues, and they're superficial, but don't set a date for defeat. Are you there?
Yeah, I am. Oh, okay. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the Democrats need to take some lessons in communication skills. This is why I wrote Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Communication, Political Persuasion. And it'll be coming out this fall. But we wrote the book online or on the air here. We did chapter by chapter, on the air and over the course of the last year. And, hopefully it'll be a small contribution to that effort. It's, you're absolutely right. And it's a big problem. The Republicans are so on point, and they all figured this out back when Gingrich and Frank Luntz first did this with the Contract on America,
right.
And with Gingrich in the 80s. And it's been, rolling along ever since. And I guess that was the 90s that was rolled out during the Clinton administration. But in any case, this is something that the Democrats need to be paying attention to, is how do you use the language of marketing? How do you use the tools of advertising? How do you use the language and tools, frankly, of psychology to communicate in ways where your message is actually heard? It's not about manipulating people. See, if you have an honest message, it's not about manipulating people or lying to them or fooling them. It's about honestly communicating your message. These same tools can be used for manipulation and lying, and that's what the Republicans have to do because they're so out of sync with what the values of most Americans and the goals of most Americans, and frankly the vision of this country of most Americans, are inconsistent with that of the Republican Party. Their values and goals and vision have to do with the very wealthiest among us, period, end of discussion. So therefore they have to use these things like turning the estate tax into the death tax and all that kind of stuff in order to accomplish what they want or continue the war so that the war contractors can make more billions and with a B. But the Democrats do need to take a lesson from it. Phyllis, good point, and thank you for making it. Brent in Baton Rouge, and thanks for listening to The Quake. Brent in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, listening on AM 1380 there. Hey, Brent, what's up?
Tom, you're my favorite guy on Air America.
Thank you.
Have you seen the WeareChange.org video where they confront Giuliani?
No, I have not.
A lot of the 9/11 victims' families confront him, and he's caught lying. It's a really great video, and I encourage anybody to see it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah,
and
I'll have to track that down. That is the thing that I think is really going to come back to haunt Giuliani, is the fact that the firefighters, I mean, anybody from New York knows the real story. And what's so weird about all this is that most of the national media is based in New York, and yet none of the pontificators and talking heads and pundits are talking about the real story of, how Giuliani, after the World Trade Center was bombed the first time, Giuliani moved the communications headquarters there, which was an absolute idiotic thing to do and was warned against. He didn't upgrade the radios and whatnot. After the World Trade Center came down, he cleaned the site up in, 9 months? And the projection was it was going to take 30 months, because it's not just a mess, it's a crime scene.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, he said to the firefighters and everybody else, oh, yeah, you can go down there. The buildings are filled with asbestos and toxic metals, but don't worry about it. And now you've got tens of thousands of people who worked at Ground Zero who are suffering not just from respiratory diseases, but, this stuff also got into their bloodstream from cancers of various organs and of the blood. I mean, there's just all these diseases. You're absolutely right, Brent. And I think that's the thing, that if Giuliani becomes the nominee, the Democrats should take a lesson from the Republicans and attack people on their strengths. This is Giuliani's only strength, is that he is perceived outside of New York City as somebody who was strong on 9/11. And just the same way the Swift Boat veterans went after Kerry on what was perceived to be his strength, being a war hero, arguably it was, you know, from my point of view, the Democrats should be, and I think frankly will be using this against Giuliani. I'm surprised more of the Republicans haven't brought it up. I'm surprised that Mitt Romney, for example, hasn't brought it up. But it probably will be as this race starts getting hotter, the primary. Mark in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, not Wolfowitz, not Bolton, Robert Zoellick. I get them all mixed up.
The new World Bank president.
Yeah, I get them mixed up.
The latest guy from Goldman Sachs to take a major role in the Bush administration activities.
Yeah, well, I heard you talk about him and his record in the trade relations department. And all those trade rules that he helped pass that made it more difficult for the people in poor countries to live there and make them want to come up here. I'm wondering if his being as a head of World Bank will make it more likely that there'll be more immigrants into this country competing with the middle class or in any all classes maybe for jobs and other. Social programs.
It may well be. I think, frankly, that has more to do with the willingness of our employers to employ people than it does the disastrous circumstances in Mexico. Mexico, about 50% of the Mexican population is living in poverty. And that was also true 60 years ago. It was also about 50%. And, you know, 60 years ago, we didn't have the problem that we have now because Americans, by and large, the American companies could not, in large part because of the oversight of unions, could not employ people who were not citizens of the United States. So I don't think that it's going to affect the immigration issues into the United States. It is going to, however, in my opinion, Bob Zoellick becoming the head of the World Bank is going to, you know, it's one more right-wing ideologue. It's one more neocon. It's one more believer, one more guy who drank the Tom Friedman, Milton Friedman Kool-Aid. It's one more guy who is Wolfowitz. I mean, you know, this is what Wolfowitz's agenda was this so-called neoliberal agenda, which is the word that is used in Europe. I refer to it as conservative economics because it makes, you know, it's shorthand for it. It's just extremely destructive. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom. Thank you. Very quickly, I'm in a panic about an immigration bill amendment offered by Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, Amendment 1170. Which would require all voters to show photo IDs at the polls beginning January 1 of next year.
Yeah, just in time for the 2008 election.
Right. And just to, may I quote from the League of Women Voters very quickly?
Sure.
Senator McConnell's amendment represents a cheap political trick to keep legal, eligible voters out of the electoral process. Photo ID requirements disproportionately stifle the voices of people of color, the elderly, young people, and others by tying a photo ID requirement to an already contentious immigration bill. Senator McConnell is merely attempting to rouse the fears of the American people.
Good point, Karen, and well made. And it actually even goes beyond that. What Senator McConnell is trying to do is trying to ensure Republican victories in the fall. This is what the whole federal prosecutor thing is about. They wanted these guys to go after so-called voter fraud. That is, they wanted them to intimidate minorities and poor people away from voting. And you know, it's a very simple, very straightforward process. Paul Weyrich, the architect of Ronald Reagan's victory and a major consultant to George W. Bush, Paul Weyrich, the godfather of the modern-day Republican Party, speaking to a group of Christian Republican activists in a church, had the following to say on this topic.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So there you go. And that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to drive down the voting populace. It's just that simple. Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. You know, it's very disturbing to me that virtually no one in the media offers any insightful or even knowledgeable discussion of what has to be considered the worst conspiracy crime and assault on our nation since the murder of President Kennedy. And that would be 9/11, which clearly was in part an inside job. And, of course, the reason is the corporate media is a facilitator of this Bush regime and their policies, including PBS, I might add. And, unfortunately, most in the alternative media, including Air America, follow right along with them, and I have the same concerns about our hackable electronic vote machines and HABA and the lack of meaningful...
Dick, I got it. And I share your concerns about the fact that there have been no meaningful investigations of 9/11, and we need one now.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's our Anything Goes Friday. And Alan Ryder's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Alan.
Good day. I guess we'll start out with the announcements from the White House. Dan Perino this morning admitted that there is a shift on global climate change by the president. This is, of course, the same time that Nancy Pelosi had a news conference in Europe today essentially said that she wanted Bush to come up with a commitment that was real and that she would hope that he would have an open mind to the science and urgent need to act. And, of course, this against the NASA guy yesterday, as we talked about, saying, well, there really wasn't much we needed to do about this.
Yeah, have you heard the latest White House spin on that? They're saying that when he said that, here it is right here. This is from the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. They say, yesterday, NPR asked NASA Administrator Michael Griffin, are you concerned about global warming? His answer, I'm aware that global warming exists, but whether it's a long-term concern or not, I can't say. I'm not sure it's fair to say that it's a problem we must wrestle with. And so today they said it's pretty obvious that the NASA administrator was speaking about his own personal views and by no means representing or attempting to represent the administration's views or broader policy. He's got a wry sense of humor and is very outspoken. In other words, he was telling a joke.
By basically saying, well, the president had shifted.
Yeah.
So they're trying to marginalize him, make the president look like he really did change his mind.
Mm-hmm. In preparation for
G8.
Yeah, this is all about the G8. And afterwards, it'll be back to business as usual, I predict.
Well, that's exactly it, because otherwise you'd get rid of the NASA guy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The next thing that I think is fascinating, and I know internally how this works, the Washington Times reported this morning that the RNC is laying off dozens of the finance staff. These are the guys that sit in the basement every day, actually in the afternoons and evenings. They're paid about $7.50 an hour, and then they get a bonus if they bring in more money. And they basically said that they're moving from a phone-based way of getting money to an internet-based system. They're laying off 65 telephone people. Well, I have a friend that was between Republican jobs when the Republicans all got laid, lost the House, and he essentially said that they would get calls all the time. These are long-term little old ladies that, give $25, $50, furious with Bush about this, that, and the other. But apparently now they are furious about this the immigration issue, and they're just having a very, very hard time collecting money, and they really can't keep these people alive, even paying them $7.50 an hour to make 300 calls. They're expected to make about 300 calls a night.
Wow. And so what's happening is when they call up longtime Republican donors, instead of hearing, oh, sure, I'd be glad to send you $25, they're getting an earful. The people are giving them hell.
That's right. Originally, from my source there, was telling me that when he called up people, he was getting a lot of grief about the war, some about the economy or gas prices. But apparently, it has changed now to immigration, and people are furious, and they're just not collecting the money. I don't know how they think by changing to an immigration-based situation they're going to make money, but hey.
Yeah.
I've got the Republican National Committee.
Yeah, the Republican Party melts down as we watch, in other words.
Exactly. And we know that the reason that apparently they're keeping Rick Renzi in Arizona 1 and these other guys is because they do not have the money to mount a special election campaign. The DCCC, I mean, the RCCC doesn't.
That's interesting, so, too.
So they are really hurting like the Democrats were 8 years ago or 6 years ago. 6 years ago, I guess.
Is it as bad or worse?
I think it's probably worse. But you know, I haven't, since they're not, we don't really know yet what their fundraising has been in the last quarter, and won't know for a while, it's hard to say how much money they're really taking in.
Yeah. Okay.
Also,
by the way, you know, I'm curious what your Republican connections on the Hill have to say about Peggy Noonan. She wrote a column today. She says that the Bush supporters, conservative Bush supporters, have felt like sufferers of battered wife syndrome.
Well, you know, Peggy Noonan is a conservative to the core, and actually there's nobody on the Hill to really ask about it. I know Peggy quite well, actually, and she's a very close friend of my counterpart on Fox, Jim Pinkerton, and we've gone to places together and that kind of stuff. But she is, to the core, a conservative, and is very connected to that sort of group of people. And
she says Bush has torn the conservative coalition asunder with consequences for the American future. She says this White House thinks its base is stupid.
Well, she's obviously angry, and as you know, was very connected to Reagan, and I would be interested to see what she does with Thompson.
Yeah, interesting.
Because he's the new big hope for the Republican Party.
Except that this guy was an alligator shoes lobbyist for 20 years for Big Pharma, and I mean he was a senator for one term, he was a lobbyist for 20 years, he was a lawyer for a while, and he's been an actor, you know, putting on makeup and posing in front of he's on his second wife who's younger than his daughter. He embodies the Hollywood values, in quotes, that the Republicans love to hate.
Yes, but look at the family relationships of Mr. Reagan.
Oh yeah, yeah. I guess it's the same thing. And I shouldn't. And by Hollywood values,
what happened.
It's a dangerous phrase, but yeah. But that's the Republican shorthand for those, you know, for. Oh man, it just Fred Thompson is not the guy that the media is portraying him as, and it just baffles me, you know, how he gets away with that. But again, you know, time will tell on all these things. Who's your bet for who's going to win the Republican primary, Ellen?
At this point, without seeing Thompson really in the race, I would say Giuliani. But if Thompson gets in the race, I'll have to wait and see what the polls are showing.
Yeah,
and how he does.
We live in interesting times. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
I don't know if they're called bonobos or bonobos. I think it's bonobos. Bonobos? Chris. Bonobos. Chris knows.
Yeah, bonobos.
Chris Lobresto. Yeah, bonobos. These apes, but there's a group of them that understand English. Really. Seriously. This is ABC News, John Berman reporting. You can talk to the apes and they know what you're saying. They actually hear the words coming out of your mouth and they know what you are saying. The superstar is a 26-year-old named Kanzi, and who talks back by pointing to lexigrams, to pictures, and you know, responds. He says, qualitatively, there is no difference between Kanzi's language and my language. It's a matter of degree. He speaks to Kanzi in English. Kanzi speaks back to him by pointing to pictures, because these bonobos can't, these small apes, they're part of the great ape family, I guess, they don't have vocal cords that work as ours do, and their tongues don't work the way ours do. They can't form words, but He says, when I'm around them, we just kind of talk normally. I use my normal vocabulary, my normal voice, my normal gestures. And he's estimating that there are 10 to 50,000 of these animals plus 50 to 55,000 orangutans, close relatives, in the wild. And that we share 99.4% of our DNA with them. Now, so then, this goes to the next step. This Dateline Vienna, Austria, by William Cole for the Associated Press. In some ways, Heisel is like any other Viennese. Viennese, a person who lives in Vienna, Austria. He indulges a weakness for pastry, likes to paint, and enjoys chilling out watching TV. But he doesn't care for coffee and isn't actually a person, at least not yet. In a case that could set a legal precedent for granting basic rights to apes, animal rights advocates are seeking to get the 26-year-old male chimpanzee legally declared a person. Hey, if you could declare a corporation a person, why not a chimpanzee? Organizers could set up a foundation to collect cash for Heisel, whose life expectancy in captivity is about 60 years, but without basic rights, they contend, he could be sold to someone outside Austria where the chimp is protected by strict animal cruelty laws. This is because the animal sanctuary where he and another chimp, Rosie, have lived for 25 years recently went bankrupt. And they're concerned that they're going to be, you know, who knows what could happen to them. And one of the folks says, if we don't declare him a person, if we can get him declared a person, he would have the right to own property. And then you could donate something to him, he'd have the right to receive it. It would be the first time the species barrier had been crossed for legal personhood, says Jan Kramer, Chief Executive of Animal Defenders International, which is working to end the use of primates in research. She goes on to say, chimps share 99.4% of their DNA with humans. And then, of course, speaking of chimps, this in the thinkprogress.org blog from the Center for American Progress, Georgianne Geyer writes today in the Dallas Morning News about President Bush's strange behavior during a recent meeting with friends of his from Texas. By all reports, President Bush is more convinced than ever of his righteousness, she writes in the Dallas Morning News. Friends of his from Texas were shocked recently to find him nearly wild-eyed, thumping himself on the chest three times while he repeated, I am the president. He made it clear he was setting Iraq up so his successor could not get out of, quote, our country's destiny, end quote. This notes the Center for American Progress. This is the second time in recent weeks that accounts have surfaced of Bush lashing out or ranting in private meetings when responding to criticism of his Iraq policy. The Nelson Report, Chris Nelson's Nelson Report, offered a similar account earlier this month. Quote, some big money players up from Texas recently paid a visit to their friend in the White House. The story goes that they got exactly one question out. And the rest of the meeting consisted of the president in an extended whine, a rant, actually, that no one about how no one understands him, the critics are all messed up, if only people would see that he's doing things would be okay, et cetera, et cetera. This is called a bunker mentality, and it's not attractive when a friend does it. When the friend is the president of the United States, it can be downright dangerous. Apparently, the Texas friends were suitably appalled, hence the story now in circulation. End of quote from the Nelson Report. Like the tearful House Minority Leader John Boehner, Bush needs to channel his bottled-up emotions. Needs to channel his bottled-up emotions toward a more worthy end, winding down the war in Iraq rather than defending the status quo. Yeah, to say the very least. So, just strange stuff. Strange stuff. For example, this our. Crazy alert for the day. Maybe I'm crazy. Actually, I think we just had it. His boy thumping himself on the chest. But here, there's a Charleston, West Virginia. It's going to be a conference, a UFO conference, coinciding with the 60th anniversary of the crash in Roswell, New Mexico. Now, that's not the crazy part. I think, a lot of us, very curious about that. 55th anniversary of noxious odor-emitting monsters in Flatwoods in Braxton County. That's not crazy. 32% of people believe in lucky numbers. 60% believe in ESP. Well, count me in that bunch. 21% believe in reincarnation. You can put me in there, too. 28% believe witches exist. Nah, 34% believe in flying saucers. Yeah, that makes sense. 34% of Fox listeners approve of Bush. This is where it gets crazy. I mean, I'm 30% of Americans. So here we have more people, well, yeah, you can do the math yourself. And I'm curious, how many people believe that pigeons are actually birds? Because I thought everybody knew that pigeons are actually little robots in the planet Xenon, and the mothership comes down and lets them out. And that's why, and then, you know, comes back every year and picks them up. And that's why whenever there's a world event, whenever you see all the world leaders getting together, see, this is, yeah, this is really crazy. Anyhow, this is why whenever you see world leaders get together, there's a million pigeons. Why? Because they're spies. Whenever you're having an important conversation in the park, pigeons. There's and why do you never see baby pigeons or dead pigeons? Because they're robots. Occasionally somebody will call in and they'll say, well, I saw a dead pigeon. Yeah, that's the phony one. That's the one that the robots, you know, it's actually a duck that they've put new feathers on or something. So pigeons are, yeah, it's my story and I'm sticking by it. Danny in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I'm with you on the pigeon thing.
It's got to be. It's the only logical explanation.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, man. But that's not the reason I called. Really, I just started getting involved in political activism not too long ago. Like, I went to a town hall meeting, and I've written a letter to the newspaper and stuff like that. And I know that you talk about getting involved with the local party, which is something I want to get involved in, but I'm moving to New Orleans on Tuesday, and so I did, like, a little bit of looking online at some blogs, and a lot of people say, like, the local party down there is too far gone, and my friend who's already down there says, like, a lot of people are really disenfranchised and don't want to be involved. So my question was what's a good suggestion for how to be a good, like, positive progressive force once I get down there, you know, in a situation like that?
Yeah, show up at the meetings. I mean, in my book, Screwed, at the risk of sounding like a shameless plug, but it's actually the last chapter of the book is about this, and it profiles three people. Well, here's the shameless plug part. Powells.com is offering it at 35% off now if you're a bargain hunter. In any case, in the last chapter of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War on the Middle Class, I profile three people who actually did exactly what you're talking about. They decided to get involved. They got out there and started to participate by showing up at the local Democratic Party meetings and discovering that the Democratic Party in their areas where it was relatively fossilized, and so they brought in a bunch of friends and got in at least one case, one of the three of them got himself elected the chairman of the county party, and it just, you know, took over basically. All three of them have become major influences in the Democratic Party, and these are good, strong progressives, and this is in Colorado and New Mexico and here in Oregon, and there's stories like that all over the United States. I mean, this is what the Republicans did, or this is what the conservatives did with the Republican Party starting in the 1960s, and Barry Goldwater was the leading edge of that, and then there was a lot of pushback, and then the conservatives came back, and with Reagan they really took over the party, and it's what progressives, in my opinion, have to do with the Democratic Party, both because the progressive vision of America is the traditional view of America. I mean, we're going back to the roots, to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, but also because it's the thing that will, in my opinion, be the best survival strategy for the Democratic Party. This thing is going to go down in flames, and if it does, we could be looking at a fascist country. So I'd say show up at the local party meeting, Danny, and drop in and say hi. Sound like a plan?
Hey, it sounds like a plan. Hey, you're really inspiring me now, Tom. I appreciate it, man.
Well, call us up and let us know how it works out.
All right, cool. Hey, I will. Thanks for the buzz, man.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Danny, and thanks for listening to us there in Denver. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
This is Nova M Phoenix, 1480 KPHX. You're listening to Nova M Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
Since your iPod can go with you everywhere, so can your digital audio files. These include music, of course, but also audiobooks, podcasts, and other audio from the Internet, including The Tom Hartman Show. Small Dog Electronics has created a special web page to help you get the show and other great progressive talk shows onto your iPod. Now you can have access to the information and news that's important to you wherever you go and whatever you're doing. Small Dog Electronics is a leading Apple specialist. They carry all the new iPods and often have discontinued and refurbished iPod models in stock as well. iPods start at only $79. Point your browser to smalldog.com/tomhartman.html. Visit smalldog.com for details. Small Dog Electronics, always by your side. 1-800-511-MAX. That's 1-800-511-6227. The hour. Bill in Queens, New York. Hey, Bill, you're on the air. What's up? Hey, Bill. No Bill? Nope, no Bill. Okay, Matt in Napa, California. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a couple of points about the air defense system on 9/11. It's a little bit long, but you know, a lot of people don't realize that we had lowered the amount of jet fighters that were ready, taskable by NORAD, from 60 down to 14 at the end of the Cold War. And then secondarily and more important, I would say, is that General Myers and other statements that we really had no primary radar system that could track planes over this country. You know,
other than our air traffic control system.
Well, the aircraft, you know, that uses the transponder signal from the jetliners. And when that's turned off, then we have to rely on the old-fashioned primary systems, you know, which is bouncing the signal. And their claim is that we had no such ability. And I don't know if you know this, but Flight 77 was invisible to our air defense system for over a half hour because the claim is that we had no, you know, primary radar that could follow it. And, you know,
I find that hard to believe, Matt. I'm a pilot. And when I'm flying without a transponder, if you fly into a TSA, if you fly into a I'm forgetting the acronym now. It's been 15 years since I flew. I used to be a pilot a long ago. I still have a license, but I can't. You know, I'd have to go out and do three tests, and I'd be a dangerous pilot right now. But anyhow, the point is, it used to be if flying a small plane without a transponder into a controlled area, you know, into like, you know, the airport around Detroit or something, the controllers immediately knew you were there. And they give you hell for it.
Well, I guess the point is that it is unbelievable, Tom, you know. But this is what they're claiming. This is what's stated in the 9/11 Commission report, and David Ray Griffin's new book, you know, summarizes it quite well. And, you know, that previously to 9/11, we were always told that Langley was basically responsible for the air defense over Washington, D.C. But the official story tells us that Langley was not, the jets at Langley were not taskable by NORAD that day. And they changed their website from what it had said the day before 9/11 in terms of taskable aircraft and changed it afterwards.
Right.
So I just think, you know, you don't hear about the air defense story.
Oh, I know. There's just a million questions here. You know, in terms of conspiracy theories, I lean more in the direction of these guys knew something was coming. They knew it was probably coming from an airplane because there were all these warnings about that. I mean, Bush had been at the G8 meeting in Italy a few months earlier and had to sleep on an aircraft carrier because there was a threat that Bin Laden was going to hijack a plane and crash into the hotel he was supposed to stay in. You know, he actually moved for that. And then what, 4 months later on 9/11, Rice is going, oh, we couldn't have imagined they turned an aircraft carrier. No, they actually, you know, you had moved the president because that had been threatened to him several months earlier. So, you know, my guess, and this
Can I make
is
a
wild...
another quick point?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and then on the Pentagon crash, you know, the FBI took control of that situation right away, and you've seen perhaps the film of them picking up pieces of debris off the lawn within hours after the crash. And in general, in investigative procedures, that's not what you do. You at least take photographs of what's there before you pick it up. And then, more importantly, that they never have come out with any type of official report on what happened there. So they took control of the investigation and then have said nothing about it.
Yeah.
You know,
they took control of the investigation. Giuliani destroyed a crime scene. I mean, it goes on and on. As I was saying, my take on it is that they had some sense that something was coming, and they did nothing to protect us. And whether they did that for political purposes because they thought it would be a Reichstag kind of event or not, you flip a coin. I could go either way. I could argue either side of that. You know, I'm not yet to the point where I think that the Bushies were actually involved in it, but I But again, I mean, do a serious investigation. I am open to anything at this point. These guys, nothing would surprise me. Bob in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Hello?
Bob, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, you know that compact fluorescent bulbs contain mercury?
I do.
Yeah, I wonder how many hazmat teams, hazmat cleanups it's going to take for them to become illegal.
Well, they're transitional. All fluorescent bulbs contain mercury, and we've had fluorescent bulbs in office buildings for forever, and in schools and in you know, everywhere. I mean, you know, fluorescent bulbs have just been kind of the standard ever since the 1950s because they use less energy. And so, you know, yes, these smaller ones that people can use in their homes, they also contain mercury, and they should be disposed, they should be recycled properly to try to recover that mercury. The long-term solution is to go to LEDs. We now have these high-intensity light-emitting diodes, and it's just a matter of, you know, these technology transitions. You go, you know, one step, and then the next step, and then the next step. As the technology improves, the ability to use the technology improves. So I think that the fluorescent bulbs are just a transitional thing, and within a year or two, maybe three, we're going to see most of the new light bulbs coming out being the high-intensity LEDs, which have much smaller, they also have rare earth minerals in them, some of which are toxic, but much, much smaller levels and much more stable. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Germans are all upset because the price of beer is going up. Why? Because they're growing so much biodiesel, you know, rapeseed oil and things to make biodiesel out of, that it's competing with the cost of the beer raw ingredients. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Better recognize your brothers. Everyone you meet.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, our local sponsors in particular on the radio station you're listening to, and also our national sponsors like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends at 1-866-380-MEOW. Bradley in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Bradley, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great listening to your program.
Thank you.
I've been listening for about 4 years. I'm really nervous. I don't often call radio programs. But I do have an issue I wanted to talk about. I think it was irresponsible for you to suggest last Monday that they've won when we've moved to Canada. I think it's we're committing potential emotional, financial, spiritual, and physical suicide if we're not planning a backup strategy, especially for the LGBT community. And, you know, that backup strategy could take up to, it could take years to develop. And one of the strategies could be immigrating to Canada. And moving to Canada doesn't mean you're giving up your citizenship. You can still vote. You can still stay involved, especially with the Internet. And Canada allows same-sex marriages, and it recognizes binational couples, and it makes it easier for you to immigrate to other Commonwealth countries. So it just seems to put all our eggs in one basket is kind of mistaken, especially with what's going on in the U.S.
Two thoughts on that. The
sure.
First is my son recently, to make a long story short, his girlfriend is working on her Ph.D. and was in school in Toronto, and he tried to move there. To be there with her, and he's finished up his master's at the University of Georgia, wanted to go and finish that in Toronto as well. It is damn near impossible for an American to move to Canada unless you're willing to put, you know, $500,000 into a business and jump through a zillion hoops. They will not let you in, and once you get in, they will not let you work. And if they find that you've been there for more than 6 months without working or without permission of the government, they will throw your butt in jail or deport you. I mean, they're really serious about it. It's really hard to get in, number one. Number two, if all the folks you know, you're framing this in the context of the gay marriage issue, but you know, we could take any dimension of it. If all the folks, for example, in Mexico who are fleeing economic deprivation, instead of, much of it caused, frankly, by the United States, but I would say the majority of it caused by an oligarchic system where 36 families basically own 70-80% of all the wealth in Mexico, a direction that we're moving in, by the way. But nonetheless, if those people, those 12 to 20 million people who are now in the United States, arguably the best and the brightest, or at least certainly the most motivated, if they had stayed in Mexico and become political and social activists rather than moving to the United States, frankly, I don't think that you'd have a conservative government in Mexico right now. I think it would have been taken back by its people.
Well, I just wanted to kind of respond to your first issue. I was looking at going to Canada as an investor, and it is a very difficult process. But I, after talking to three, four lawyers, they said I could easily immigrate as a skilled worker. I hired a Canadian immigration lawyer. You don't have to, but it's
right.
A good idea.
But
and
you've got more money than the average person.
I'm sorry.
But you have more. Clearly, you have more money than the average person because this
but,
is
know,
something
that doesn't
that...
matter because I'm actually immigrating as a skilled worker. I don't have to have any money. The process takes two and a half years, and then once I get my PR status, I have 3 years to decide whether I want to move to Canada or not. And it was much easier than I ever expected. I'd been retired up, you know, for 6 years, and they have a very liberal immigration policy for skilled workers. It's absolutely
incredible. Do you mind my asking Bradley what your skill is?
Well, I used to manage my own rental property, and they consider my management skills worthy enough for me to immigrate, and they give, I mean, if you're between 21 and 49, they give you maximum points, and I'm approaching 50, and I was astonished that I qualified, having been retired for 6 years, and didn't think my skills were any longer needed, and because I'd also looked into immigrating to New Zealand as well, but
I understand the I think very natural human instinct to pursue what's in your own best interest, you know. But
a basket case if I stay here in the U.S. I mean, emotionally, spiritually, I mean, financially, I've moved 60% of my money out of U.S. dollars. I don't want to be part of the problem, and I can still participate in Canada. I'm, you know, immigrating to Vancouver, still can come across the border if I feel safe enough to do so, and I've been involved, you know, with the political process ever since the 2000 elections, and just them becoming increasingly scared. And I don't know how bad it gets, and I know there's a lot of comparisons to Nazi Germany, et cetera, but if I've moved out of the country and moved my money out of the country, I can still stay involved and may be in a better situation to do so.
You realize that Canada is not without its bigots.
Oh, certainly. Certainly.
I mean, there are redneck. You know, I've spent a fair amount of time in Canada, and I've lived on the Canadian border and states on the Canadian border for probably half my life in Michigan and Vermont and New Hampshire, well, Michigan and Vermont in particular. And there's as many, you know, gun-toting, pickup-driving rednecks in Canada as there are in the United States, proportional to the population.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's less. And some of those bigots actually immigrated north during the Dust Bowl era. And thanks, America. But there are fewer.
There is a greater sense of kind of a cultural refinement, an almost European. But I still, you know, back to your original point, Bradley, I'm not ready to give up on the United States. And,
not either.
All right. If you're then just moving your location, but you're not really withdrawing your citizen, you know, it's just
you can have dual citizenship and for those that are in the process, I mean, if you start the process of immigrating to Canada, it takes two and a half years, and then you have an additional 3 years to decide whether you want to let your PR staff go. So,
well, then what you're talking about doing is something that's really sort of in that kind of gray area between I'm the hell out of here on the one hand, and I'm going to stay and fight on the other. Because you're talking about you're going to move, you're going to do something that's going to work out for you economically and emotionally and spiritually, and yet at the same time you're going to stay involved in American politics. And so it's kind of a gray area. And so, you know, I can't say that I would condemn you for that. I certainly wouldn't.
And if things get bad here in the U.S., you know, I'm safer. and I have other options, moving to another Commonwealth country. And
on the other hand, if you were to stay here in the United States, you could help us make this a better country.
Oh, I can do that from Canada as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope so. And it's an interesting conversation, Bradley. Thank you very much for the call. I've got to move along. I'm sorry. It's just Brian in Portland, Maine. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Thanks for your daily civics lesson. You're the civics teacher none of us could ever afford. So appreciate it. Make it entertaining.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that my candidate's Dennis Kucinich all the way, but I'm a big supporter of Ron Paul, and he's a big hero for being the only non-Batman supervillain up there on the stage.
Yeah, although you realize that Ron Paul wants to end Social Security. He wants to end unemployment insurance. He doesn't think that there should be any national health care for the United States.
Excellent.
He does, you know, okay.
Thank you for pointing that out. You're a hero for doing that, and you're also a hero for being honest and truthful about 9/11. And I just wanted to say that that video the guy was talking about Giuliani being caught in a lie,
yeah,
you got to check out the video. Everybody should see him with Peter
Dennis. I tried to Google it during the last break, and what I came up with was Chris Matthews calling Giuliani out on a lie on David Letterman. But what are the words that I should plug into the search engine over at YouTube?
There you go. We were operating out of 75 Barclay Street, quote, when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse, unquote. And he lied about it to these people on the street, a victim family member. It's excellent video, but mainly the Jennings quote. Everyone to see it. You're a hero, Tom. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. I still need the search. Somebody in the chat room will probably track it down. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Yeah, spoken before about contracting out in the Postal Service.
Oh, you've got the website.
Yeah, right.
Please plug your website.
It's www.postalworkersunited.blogspot.com.
Okay.
We got started to fight the threat of opening mail without a warrant, but we're also facing this contracting out situation. And if people want to save their regular mailman, their union mailman, they ought to check out the website, sign the petition, and get involved. There's a Senate bill put forward by Tom Harkin, right, to Congress, and have their senators support that. It's SB 1457, and it will end contracting out of letter carrier work.
Yeah, that would be a great thing. We had that happen here in a suburb of, and thanks for the call, Jeff, in a suburb of Portland, Portland, Oregon, being where I live right now. And there was, you know, it got publicized in the community. And there was, my recollection is that there was so much public pressure that they decided not to privatize this kind of satellite post office. And bring in basically the pizza delivery boys and girls to deliver the mail, but rather we're going to go back to union postal employees who have a long-term commitment to the process and good training and you know all those things that, I mean, frankly, I don't want my paycheck or my credit card bills or anything like that being delivered by the cheapest worker working for a company that, you know, is just dancing to the profit motive and nothing else. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A special thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Lopresto and Lauren Kirshner at Air America New York, to Ben at the White Rose Society, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you. It's what keeps us going here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Ken in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk to you. Number one, I want to say that you're my hero. Yeah, and I dittos about being a good civics teacher. And also, you always tell the callers when they do good, good spot on you. And I can say that to you too, Tom.
Okay, well, thank you, Ken. We've got to start truncating these things. Okay, your point you called about.
Yeah, I called. I was watching Scarborough Country yesterday, last night, and this guy, Vince, I don't know if I'm saying his name right,
Bugliosi.
Yeah, his book, Reclaiming History. I mean, talk about a whitewash of the JFK assassination. Oh, this guy didn't. I mean, your research was so in-depth, but this guy was just more or less repeating the Warren Commission.
Well, he was, not just the Warren Commission, but also some of Gerald Posner's stuff. I don't disagree at all, Ken. It would be inappropriate to go much farther than that because I wrote a competing book, or I co-authored a competing book on the topic, Ultimate Sacrifice, and about John and Robert Kennedy and the coup overthrow attempt in Cuba and how that in part led to the assassination of Kennedy. So, but yeah, there's a couple of new books that David Talbot has one too, that are arguing their positions, and I just encourage people to, if you know, people who are really into it, to read them all and make up your own mind. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Robert in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Robert.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to.
Sure. If we're on a speakerphone here, Robert, can you pick up the phone, please?
Here we go. I'm sorry. A little while ago, Bernie Sanders was talking about how the Bush administration reinvents the word outrageous almost on a daily basis. Well, yeah. I can't think of anything much more outrageous than their recent position they've taken regarding the testing of mad cow disease. By way of background, for those of your listeners who haven't heard about this, there was a small cow producer, I believe in Kansas, that was seeking to test 100% of its cattle. And the right
so they could sell them to Japan, because Japan will only import 100% tested beef.
Exactly. But yep. This company, which is seeking to do this, has been blocked by big agriculture in this country. Obviously, if somebody can put on their label 100% free tested of mad cow disease, who's going to want to buy Brand X? So they're apoplectic about this, and through pressure on the Bush administration, the agricultural department, they've actually tried to appeal this in court, which is what they're doing right now. And I, for personally, you know, the Democrats seem so clueless when it comes to political savvy sometimes. Whether they realize it or not, this is a huge wedge issue. I would like to see them force Congress, the Republicans in Congress, defend the president on this one. Unlike something like free trade, which is somewhat bloodless and abstract for a lot of people, this is something that has immediate implications to the majority of Americans, and I think they
should
go to town with this issue.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Robert. And this is a variation, by the way, on what happened to Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's ice cream in Vermont. It's interesting. When we first moved to Vermont 12 years ago, we lived there for 10 years before 2 years ago we moved here to Portland, Oregon. And I remember going with some friends to the Ben and Jerry's factory, and they've got this long wall with the history of the company. And part of the history of the company is that they put no RGBH, no recombinant bovine growth hormone, no RGBH milk on their labels. And I think it was USDA, it might have been the FDA, but I think it was the U.S. Department of Agriculture came along and said, you can't do that. You can't say that. And this was because they were obviously getting pressure from the manufacturers of this bovine growth hormone. I think it's Monsanto, but I may be wrong. I'm pretty sure, though. So there was this long court case and all this. And the argument was, well, if you say there's no RGBH, then everybody else is going to say, the consumers are going to, it's going to cause confusion in the marketplace. The consumers are going to be confused because other ice cream doesn't say no RGBH or it does, or whatever. And so, that actually swung in two different directions over time, that ruling. And, we'll see how this whole thing shakes out with the same deal with mad cow disease. And I think you're right. It could be a great wedge issue. Rebecca in Woodland, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Tom, everyday listener. I just wanted to point one out from the ironic zone. Memorial Day, Monday. Mm-hmm. I believe I heard on the bottom of the Northwest News little block that up in Fort Lewis, they're not going to bury soldiers every week because there's too many of them. So we're just going to bury them once a month.
Yeah,
and I thought that was so disrespectful, and I've seen nothing in the paper about it at all. So.
Yeah, well, it has been reported. I believe it was reported, the Associated Press reported it. I don't know about, you're in the neighborhood of Fort Lewis, aren't you?
Well, I'm actually just on the other side of the river from Portland.
Ah, okay. In,
yeah.
Oh, in Woodland. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought
your
you were
neighbor.
Up in San Luis. There you go. There you go. Well, I don't know how it's being reported in, you know, around Fort Lewis, but I, but around the nation it has been reported. The Associated Press picked it up and the Oregonian had picked it up. So, yeah, but it is incredibly ironic. And David says that the Seattle Times published the story. So I don't think it was a secret. It's just, it didn't get the kind of, boy, is this ironic press coverage that probably it deserved. Certainly, if it had happened during the Clinton administration, it would have been everywhere. Anyhow, next week I'll be broadcasting this show Monday and Thursday live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. Peter B. Collins will be filling in for me the other 3 days of the week. And we look forward to talking with you, and it's going to be great. I'm going to be at the Praxis Peace Conference. We're going to have a lot of fun. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.